Smith versus Commonwealth, Peter Francis and J. Andrew Taylor, Appellant Counsel, Patrick Quinn, Philadelphia, Assistant Attorney General, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Thank you, sir. May it please the court, my name is Peter Francesca and I represent the appellant James Willie Bethea. I know members of the tribunal have reviewed the briefs. I would just like to elaborate on a couple of points I made briefly. The Court of Appeals erred when they determined that the prosecutor, while admitting the prosecutor did not ask the question that the prosecutor claimed the juror did not answer, ask a similar question. And I submit to this tribunal that, in fact, the questions, when looked at in the context of the voir dire and in their entirety, are not similar at all. The question that the prosecutor claimed the juror did not answer, the basis for the strike, emphasized the consideration of all the evidence. The question that the Court of Appeals claimed was similar, and therefore that must have been the question the prosecutor was really referring to, emphasized the juror's feelings about the lawyers involved. Said, and you won't take into account who we are, meaning the lawyers, and whether or not you like us, but you will focus on the evidence. So that question that she did ask, the emphasis was entirely on whether or not you like or your feelings about the lawyers involved in the trial. The question she claimed the jury did not respond to emphasized considering all the evidence.
May I ask you this?
Yes, sir.
The trial judge said, in response to the prosecutor's race-neutral explanation, I do recall when you made the request, when the jury was to raise the hand, this is at 767 of the JA, but at no point did the defense attorney say, no, actually, if you recall, you were wrong, because that didn't happen. And the trial judge added, well, I wasn't looking at everything, but the defense attorney said, well, I was scanning everything, but she never said, he or she never said that.
First, Your Honor, the prosecutor did ask the jurors to raise their hand to one question only, and that question involved the law on motive. And the question was phrased that she said that, okay, the law requires us to prove who and how, but not why. Does anyone here have a problem with that law? If so, raise your hand. Meaning if the jury would raise her hand, they were going to force the commonwealth to prove motive, regardless of the offense.
In voir dire, you have to ask every single time you make your question, you have to repeat, raise your hand. I mean, a lot of times it's like a given. I'm going to ask a bunch of questions.
Well, Your Honor, some questions imply raising your hand. For instance, Commonwealth asked, anyone here watch CSI? Well, yeah, you would raise your hand. But some questions were questions that, well, anyone here consider the evidence? Well, some might raise their hand, some might say yes. And the judge did, in fact, ask the prosecutor, did she respond in some other fashion? Did she nod her head? The prosecutor ignored the question and never answered it, just repeated she did not raise her hand.
Well, one of the questions was, does everyone agree that you'll decide this case based upon what we present to you? How do we know, looking at a trial court record, that, you know, everybody but her raised her hand? I mean, you've tried many cases. I've probably tried much less in the number, but that's the way it works a lot of times.
Yes, sir. But what is very telling about this, and I'll try to answer your question in, I guess, a roundabout way, is that on the motion to strike, or not the motion to strike, excuse me, the motion to set aside the verdict, the Commonwealth, the defense, both had a transcript. We knew what was said. And if all the prosecutor did was misstate the question, the easiest thing in the world, the most logical thing to do, would be to come in and tell the trial court, yes, Your Honor, I misstated the question, I apologize for that, but it was this question right here in the transcript. The prosecutor never did that. Three times during argument on the motion to set aside the verdict, the defense raised that question. What are we talking about? What question are we talking about? That was never answered. It's never been answered.
But those questions have to be asked not after you lose the case, but at the time of the voir dire. The trial judge is not going to throw a verdict out because a pretty good Batson argument could have been made prior to trial, but wasn't made.
Well, yes, sir. At the trial, no one had a transcript. Now, obviously, all four lawyers involved, good lawyers, members in good standing of the Virginia State Bar. And as such, we have a right, in fact, we must rely on the factual assertions made to opposing counsel. Now, we might argue about the meaning of those facts, interpretation of those facts, the importance of those facts. But the Commonwealth is very specific about the question they ask. I believe the defense, as well as the trial court, had a right to rely on that assertion.
And the transcript actually showed that as opposed to raising hands in response to that question, the transcript shows that the jury panel said yes.
Yes, ma'am. That's absolutely correct. The jury did respond. And there's no indication that the jury in question did not respond to that question. But again, the Court of Appeals, I don't think the questions are similar. And if they were so similar, why couldn't the prosecutor identify
them? Let me ask you this question. In this context, when the prosecutor offers a race-neutral reason, and the court says, no, that's pretextual. So the court is essentially making a factual finding that someone is not stating the truth. So normally, with that kind of factual finding,
I mean, I recognize you don't have a witness under oath. You have a lawyer standing in front of you,
but it's very similar conceptually. Normally, we defer to a trial court's factual finding. And here, the court was presented with one argument, and then at the back end, the motion to reconsider, a different argument. And the trial judge sees the lawyers, prosecutors, probably nearly every day, and it would have a pretty good idea this person's just, it's a pretext or it's not. So I could see setting aside a factual finding like in the U.S. Supreme Court case out of Georgia where there's written notes that flatly contradict what's being said and so on. And it's just really clear that, look, and there were four black jurors in that case who were struck, all the peremptory strikes. Here, my understanding is there are four strikes, right?
Yes, sir.
Two were used for African-American jurors. But the court made the comment there's still some African-American jurors on the jury.
If I recall correctly, sir, there was one that served on the jury.
Well, the court made the comment. So in other words, the prosecutors didn't exercise their peremptories to weed out systematically every black person on the jury. So with all that said, it's just an awkward position to be on appeal to say, look, trial judge, you made this particular factual finding. You know these folks. Then on appeal, we have to draw a contrary inference because there was a mistake on the ground asserted. That's what makes it difficult for me.
Yes, sir. And Court of Appeals addressed that the trial court, the trial judge, of course being the man on the scene, is given great deference. I submit to this tribunal that a prerequisite for that great deference is meaningful inquiry. And how can a trial court conduct a meaningful inquiry if we're not even sure what question it is the prosecutor is referring to? I mean, it's a moving target. Well, it's not even a moving target because you can occasionally hit a moving target. This was no target at all.
We have is a prosecutor making a either false or mistaken assertion as to why a strike was made. You want us to draw the inference that establishes it's pretextual. But alternatively, maybe they're just mistaken. So suppose I mistakenly recollect that someone is a lawyer, and I don't want a lawyer on my jury seizing control of the whole proceedings. So I exercise a strike. But I was wrong. That wasn't the lawyer. It was the person standing next to them. I made a mistake. You want us to draw the inference that mistake is pretextual, and it may be, but it's an awkward place to be for an appellate court.
Well, sir, the distinction between the example you gave and what happened was the prosecutor, on the motion to set aside the verdict, both in its reply to the motion itself and in its argument, had the opportunity to correct that mistake
right, by
saying, yes, sir, it was this question.
Right.
They didn't do that. And I think that is very significant. If the prosecutor who struck a person for not properly answering a very important question can't recall the question, doesn't know what question it is.
Well, suppose it was a true mistake. Batson is a constitutional principle against purposeful discrimination, not mistakes. So let's say the prosecutor made a mistake instead of that was the question that they all said yes to. darn, it should have been the question they raised their hands to. Is it possible that it was something other than purposeful racial discrimination?
Well, again, sir, I go back to they should have been able to identify the question, and the prosecutor was not able to do that.
Well, let's go to the actual Batson challenge. The statement was she didn't answer all the questions, and she appeared emotional at times. And when I asked if everyone would promise to consider all the evidence and if they would raise their hands to do so, she didn't raise her hands. The very next statement is defense attorney. I don't think that amounts to anything, Your Honor. I mean, I was watching him. If I heard that as a trial judge, I'd go, okay, he didn't think it was a big deal. I would not have heard this. Your Honor, that's just wrong. There was no question like that, and she didn't fail to put her hand up. Because if I had heard that as a trial judge, then I would start leaning into the prosecutor. None of this happened until after you lost the case. So tell me one, if I'm wrong, we have to freeze frame what the trial judge did, because we're not judging the prosecutor here, we're judging the trial judge. What did the trial judge do wrong on page 765 of the joint appendix after hearing what I just read?
Your Honor, the trial judge's error, and I use that phrase because I ran out of time, but it really wasn't his error. It was based on the assertion made by the prosecutor. Okay. The prosecutor said, I asked this question, and she did not respond to this particular question. That's what the trial judge based his ruling on. And that takes me to my next point. If the Court of Appeals is, in fact, correct, what we have is an unresolved Batson motion, because the trial court never ruled on that question that focuses on what the jurors think of the lawyers influencing the case. The trial court never ruled on whether that was pretextual or not.
But the trial court ruled here. He said, I do recall when you made the request when the jury was to raise the hand. And the prosecutor, and this is at page 767, she didn't raise her hand. I mean, if I were a trial judge hearing this, I would say, well, no one's telling me she did. Okay.
But she... Yeah. There was that question wasn't asked, so she couldn't raise her hand to that question. We don't know what was the question that she did not respond to. Was that pretextual? We don't know because we don't know what the question was, and that question was never argued to the.
How much does the statements that were allegedly made from the prior trial factor into whether this analysis is it was a mistake, she honestly thought she asked them to raise their hands, it was a different question? Does that flavor this argument?
Well, I think it does, Your Honor. Clearly, the statements that she made clearly show a belief that African-American jurors could not fairly judge an African-American defendant. I mean, I don't see how that statement can be interpreted any other way. I just don't see that.
What about the argument that what the prosecutor was allegedly saying through two tiers of hearsay is the African-American jurors were themselves biased by something called Black Lives Matter, and that bias caused a racial predisposition that was impermissible? Is that a racist statement, or is that simply acknowledging that racism could have played a role, which she is implicitly criticizing?
Well, sir, I think what it says is that the prosecutor, if that was in fact the prosecutor's belief or raceology, I think whether the prosecutor is personally racist or not, it certainly envisioned the belief that an African-American juror would not fairly judge an African-American defendant.
Well, for whatever reason. Something about Black Lives Matter, which
yes, sir,
is a modern cultural phenomenon.
Yes, sir.
And it is not simultaneously interchangeable with all African Americans or the state of being an African American. It's an ideological point of view by some.
Yes, sir. I would like to resolve some time for rebuttal, so if I may have some time just to answer. We always have phenomenons going on in this country. I mean, people charged with terrorism today and things like that. There could be phenomenons, but the point is, regardless of what you think a black juror may do, you have voir dire, you ask them these questions. and they're supposed to answer truthfully. But to arbitrarily strike minority jurors simply on the belief, for whatever reason, a political movement or whatever, that they would not fairly judge the defendant. Yes, sir, I do believe that. That's discriminatory. It's racist.
Well, sure, if she did that, but she said she didn't do that.
Well, she offered as an excuse for striking her, restraining the juror, not answering a question that she never asked, and she never identified the question that that she, according to the Court of Appeals, was referring to. If I might say my last few seconds for rebuttal.
You don't have the last few seconds. You just went right into your rebuttal.
No, correct, sir. Sorry.
May it please the Court, good morning, Catherine Adelfio on behalf of the Commonwealth. The decisions of the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court should be affirmed today because the Circuit Court's factual finding that the prosecutor did not intentionally discriminate against the juror was not clearly erroneous. The great deference afforded this factual determination takes into account the fact that the evaluation of the credibility of the prosecutor relies on a host of factors that is not readily apparent from a cold appellate record. This court has recognized repeatedly that the appellate record cannot capture all the nuances and subtleties of lower court criminal proceedings.
We certainly have no quarrel with that. But I think the case law says when the prosecutor asserts their position, then you evaluate that position. And to the extent that the position stated arguably did not occur, and to the extent that the position stated sort of changed over time, and when you put that against the backdrop of what was allegedly said from the prior trial, what else, not what else, but why can't we find that the court just was plainly wrong? The statement that was allegedly made and the reason given didn't occur.
Sure, Your Honor. If I could briefly address first the alleged pretrial statements, the double hearsay statements attributed to the prosecutor. First, any reliance on those statements were not properly encompassed by the assignment of error in this case. The assignment of error in this case only focused on the prosecutor's failure to point with specificity which question she recalled the juror failing to raise her hand to. Second, the defendant has failed to assign error to the Court of Appeals finding that the Circuit Court did not rely on that statement. As such, the Court of Appeals
Court of Appeals found that the Circuit Court did not rely on that statement.
That's correct, Your Honor. In a footnote, which I cited on brief, court's indulgence.
I don't want you to take a few time. I don't recall them saying that, but I'll find it in the opinion. You can go ahead.
It's in footnote 7 on page 502 in the Virginia Appellate Reporter. The Court of Appeals found that the Bethea did not rely on those purported comments on appeal.
But Bethea did twice in his... Bethea didn't. I thought you said that the court didn't. But Bethea did twice in his brief. If I'm reading the brief, he does rely on it.
But respectfully, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals found that Bethea did not rely on those statements.
Right.
And Bethea now has failed to assign error to that determination. And so it's binding on this court on appeal from the Court of Appeals.
Let me just – what I'm struggling – I don't know that the U.S. Supreme Court has ever said it's a factual finding. But it almost has to be where the prosecutor says one thing and, of course, saying, no, you're lying. It's pretextual. That, to me, sounds like a factual finding. It makes all the more sense when you're familiar with these lawyers. So one possible inference – and it's – We don't draw inferences on appeals. Some of the trial court does. Is, as defense counsel says, you have a statement pre-trial about this hung jury, whatever it was, hung jury. Now that imputes a motive to the prosecutor, and there's a reason given that on the record doesn't seem correct. So one inference is trial judge was wrong. On the other hand, the judge knows these lawyers and whether they might be lying or not. On the other hand, the prosecutor didn't systematically exclude every African-American juror, and the court noted at least one was, and counsel says it was one, I don't know, but at least one was on the jury. So unlike the Georgia case where four strikes, four African-Americans, here four strikes, two African-Americans, one sits, so it doesn't appear like there's a systematic effort to weed out African-Americans from the jury. And the court is given at the end of it, well, here's the transcript and here's the prosecutor was mistaken, so you should draw the inference that it's pretextual. The court refused to do that. So is it the only possible explanation, as in the Georgia case at the U.S. Supreme Court, is no, it has to be pretextual? Or is it, I don't know, it might be, it might not be, and so the trial court gets the benefit of that possibility. That's my thought process, and maybe I'm off base.
Your Honor, this court has to find that the trial court's determination was clearly erroneous, and the trial court is entitled to great deference. Very, very briefly, I'd just like to say that even taking the pretrial statements into account, it is just as likely that the prosecutor was relaying the results of the juror poll to defense counsel, and she was saying that this was the makeup of the jury poll and something about Black Lives Matter. It does not indicate a future intent to act on some sort of racist motivation in discriminating against jurors. This is not like Flowers, where there was the race of the jurors was marked up on the jury list. This is a situation where she was relating a past fact to defense counsel. I'm sure she'll never do that again. And I think that it's equally likely that she was relating the jury poll and that there was not this nefarious intent.
Or at least that would be an inference that that comment would then lead her to improperly exercise strikes.
That's correct, Your Honor. To return to the question I think is actually before the court, which is, what do we do with the fact that the prosecutor was not able to state with specificity the question that the juror did not raise her hand to? I would argue to this court that the circuit court's ultimate crediting of the prosecution's account that she struck the veneer woman because she failed to raise her hand was not clearly erroneous. There was ample evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding. Defense counsel says that there were no questions where the prosecutor asked the veneer members to raise their hand. There were multiple questions where the prosecutor asked the veneer people to raise their hands. They're found at pages 13, 17, 18, 20. They were all included in my brief. There are questions she asked them to raise their hands about whether they'd served on a jury, whether they had experience with the Prince William County Police Department. She said, raise your hand if you have a problem with the law and that you are going to require the Commonwealth to prove something the law does not require. The prosecutor further stated to the trial court during the motion to set aside the verdict argument.
What was that last one? What was the JA site for that?
That's on page 20, Your Honor. And she said, I just want to put, is everyone here willing to follow the law and absolutely make us prove the things that we have to prove to you, but not make us prove the things the law says we don't have to prove? Raise your hand if you have a problem with that law. You won't make us prove something the law says we don't have to prove. And I recognize that it's the opposite of the situation, but there's clearly throughout the voir dire, she is eliciting raised hands in response to her questions. And she said to the trial court, she and her co-counsel, Mr. Willett, said to the trial court during the argument on the motion to set aside the verdict, there were times when I was eliciting a response of raised hands visually. And the trial court apparently credited that explanation for what happened below. Because clearly there were questions in the record that are close to those that she recollected the juror not responding to. And I'd also point out When the prosecutor first stated that the juror had failed to raise her hand, the defense counsel did not challenge that assertion. And I admit that she didn't give an exact recitation. She didn't have an exact recollection of the question to which the juror did not raise her hand. But the defense attorney clearly knew which question she was talking about.
Well, that's the moment in the trial where the trial court has to decide. The facts and things got to be decided right then and there. And no one's telling the trial judge, this is wrong. Actually, there was no issue about her raising her hand.
Trial counsel said, I don't think that amounts to anything. I was watching her. I did not see her getting particularly emotional. I was scanning the jury for people to raise their hands. I do not know what that amounts to. The trial court, having heard that, was entitled to think, well, you know, he saw that she raised her hand, or failed to raise her hand, and he's saying that that failure is insignificant. Because that's essentially what trial counsel said. He said it was insignificant that she failed to raise her hand. He further argued to the trial court, look, if the prosecutor had a problem with her failing to raise her hand, she should have explored it further. So this argument on the part of trial counsel, it indicates that at least he knows that there were some questions that this particular juror, veneer person, did not raise her hands to. As I argued on brief, he did not tell the court, I don't remember that question. He did not say she raised her hand at all appropriate times. He didn't say, we need to explore this further because I just don't know. He argued, who cares? It's not significant. And I think that the fact that the prosecutor wasn't able to state with specificity which question she recalled the juror referring to, I think that argument is not persuasive. And I borrow from Justice McCullough's analogy. I think that I think a reasonable explanation for the failure to point to the question is that she still couldn't remember which question she recalled the failure to raise the hand. And it would be like a prosecutor saying, well, I think someone was an attorney. Someone said they were an attorney, but I don't know who.
I mean, we're at a fork in the road. One inference is she just made something up because she's trying to weed out African-Americans from the jury. So you should draw that inference. Other inferences, she just was mistaken about which question, and she had a bad vibe about this juror, whatever. So plausible inferences, trial judge made an... it seems to me I would have to say plain error, and it's a tougher sell on these facts than in the Georgia case, for instance.
I think that when you have two plausible explanations, you can't say that the one adopted by the circuit court was clearly erroneous. And I'd also note, again, that the trial court also recollected that there were questions where the prosecutor elicited a show of hands. He said he independently recalled the very question she was referring to, and he did not see whether the juror did not raise her hand. And so given all these facts and the fact that the record reflects that there were multiple African-Americans on the jury, because the trial court said that there are African-Americans on the jury, and that's at appendix page 40, and that's what's before this court, not counsel's assertions in oral argument, we can assume that this defendant did not, I'm sorry, the prosecutor did not systemically discriminate against...
Right, the court uses plural.
That's
there
correct,
are
Your
other
Honor.
African-Americans on the jury.
So this is not a situation like Flowers where there was an indication where the prosecution was marking the racial makeup and acting in an abhorrent manner. This is not a situation where they struck all of the African-American jurors. This is a situation where everyone apparently recalls that she asked a question where a raise of hands would have been appropriate. And it's only after the transcript was prepared that it becomes clear that perhaps everyone's memory in the heat of the moment, you know, there's a lot of things going on, was imperfect. And given this evidence, the trial court...
Your opposing counsel says, well, but why not then correct? and say, you know what, I thought it was that question, have the transcript now, it was this other question. And so his argument is the failure to do that points the inference needle in a different direction.
I think that the problem was she still couldn't remember exactly which question it was. And so to borrow your analogy, you know, she still couldn't remember which jurors said they were an attorney, so she couldn't point with specificity to it. I think we can look at the record and find that the last two questions posed by her are probably the ones where she visually requested that the jurors raise their hand. And probably that's the one where those are the questions to which the juror, the veneer woman, failed to raise her hand. But I think that based on this record, where everyone at the time the Batson strike was made appeared to recognize that there was a question where a raise of hand, that would have been the appropriate opportunity for the veneer woman to raise her hand, and it didn't. That question actually occurred.
Your time has expired.
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.